Hello and welcome to the RJM Classic Motorcycles podcast. This week we are once again doing away with our regular format to interview our very dear friend Jack. This is someone we've spoken lots about over the previous 9 episodes, but now you'll get to hear from the man himself. We recorded this interview over Skype, and I'll say right at the top that we had some real bad technical difficulties thanks to our connection playing up, but hopefully I've managed to edit around that to a large extent. Let's see. So, Jack, why don't we start off with the way that any conversation between a group of motorcyclists starts, by asking you what bikes you own?
Well, currently I have 3 British motorcycles. The first one acquired was a 1970 Triumph TR6, which my dad and I bought new, and I've held on to it about these 48 years now.
Wow.
The second one of my current bikes is a 1969 Royal Enfield Series 2 Interceptor.
I hate you. I hate you.
Now, I should say here that Ray and Jack have a little agreement, or rather, Ray has goaded Jack into an agreement.
Well, it works 2 ways. We've got an agreement, at least I hope we've got an agreement.
Yeah, Ray made the agreement. I've never put anything in writing.
Well, it's on record now, mate.
Yeah, you did say it in front of witnesses that if he does move it on, what I don't want to hear is that the next time we Skype is that he's just sold it to somebody, because I quite like it if he sells it at all, to sell it to me. Now, it may well work 2 ways, in the sense that because of the hassle of trying to get it to me, it might be simpler just to keep riding it, Jack. So enjoy.
Well, I'll carry on a bit longer, but I have a feeling it's not an old man's motorcycle, and sands of time are still running on me. So I don't know how much longer I'll be able to face it. But
there you go. Enjoy it while you can.
Yeah, enjoy it absolutely.
Let's talk more about the trophy quickly.
How many miles, Jack? How many miles from New Jack, the trophy?
I think it's 60,200 and something. Wow. I've had 60,000 this past summer.
And the original Speedo is still working, so those miles are correct?
Well, the original Speedo was working up until last fall, and it had nearly 60 on it.
Right.
Okay. And the Speedo itself was working beautifully. But the face of it came loose. The little, I think that somebody said that there were plastic rivets or
they
something
are,
holding the face on it.
Yeah.
And the face actually turned in the housing.
Oh, no,
the
right.
Speedometer needle was working brilliantly, and it was actually tracing the end of the pointer was tracing a mark on the dial. But the Speedo wouldn't give up, but the face did. So I sent it off. We have a repairman here in the States that I've done business with over the years, and did a complete rebuild on it. So hopefully it'll be good for the next 60,000.
And that's with how many engine rebuilds?
It's only had one real complete rebuild. It was back in, I think it's 84. It went in for a full rebuild.
Do you remember how many miles on it when it went for rebuild?
No, I still have the receipt. I could be digging it out as we talk, but
no need.
Probably, you know, 25 to, I'd say roughly probably 25.
Yeah. Was it a precautionary or routine?
No, I think the main bearings went out or something went out. It was deep in the engine.
Right.
And I don't really know why, because I'd been, you know, changing fluids yearly as I do.
To be fair, you do service these things within an inch of their life. All credit to you. So it wouldn't have been for lack of maintenance. This I know.
No, I'm sure it wasn't that.
So we've got the trophy. We've got the Royal Enfield. What else?
Mm-hmm. Have a 73 Norton Commando. It's an 850. It's an early 850. I think I read that they went to the 850s in March of 73, and mine was built in April of 73. But it's been pretty severely cafe'd back in the 80s, apparently, by a local craftsman and artist and motorcycle builder. And I think it's a quite tasteful treatment. But he made his own seat and tailpiece and chopped the rear frame, bobbed the rear fender, and did a 2-in-1 exhaust. And it later had a Boyer put on it. And I've drilled the front rotor, put a few holes in it to make it look a bit less Jurassic. But
for the English viewers, that's a brake disc.
Is what?
Is a brake disc. They may not know what the front rotor was.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and it was repainted by the person I bought it from. It's called Laguna Blue. It was either a 63 or 66 Corvette color. It's kind of a dark blue.
Yeah, that I didn't know.
Yeah, and it's
very tasteful.
It still has the fiberglass tank. And wow.
Yeah, there hangs a tail.
Yeah.
Yes, and of course going through the ethanol learning curve, I actually tried coating it with Caswell epoxy, and that might work in some cases, but in my case I treated it very carefully, did the procedure, but it still detected a softening of the side. So
that is the only problem with a fiberglass tank when you try and seal it against methanol. You only got to get a whisker or two of the original fiberglass poking through that sealant and it'll wick straight into the main body of the tank. Now tell our listeners and viewers how you get round the ethanol problem on that particular machine.
Well, yes. Here in Memphis, we have a couple options. One is to just go to, we got two private airports here, and you can actually go to the airports and just buy Avgas straight out of the pump.
I hate you again.
And it's that works good because, you know, they don't want stinking ethanol and Avgas in them planes up in the sky. You know, that ought to tell you something right there.
Yeah.
Ethanol is not recommended in critical situations like that. And the other option, we have a couple of gas stations which sell gasoline with no ethanol in it. Wow. They have special pumps for ethanol-free high test, as we would say.
Yeah.
And it's about a dollar more a gallon, about 90 cents more a gallon, but you don't have to worry about it. It's convenient, and you just go, you know, pump it as many as you want in your can and bring it home and put it in the Norton.
And you're still paying a lot less for it than we do. We do the regular rubbish.
No doubt. I don't know. I think it's, well, normal gas today is like $2.90 a gallon.
Say that again. You broke up slightly. How many?
Yeah. For a gallon, let's see. 2.19.
He's crunching the numbers.
2.19 divided by 1.33. 164. A pound 64 a gallon.
Fortunately, that is a US gallon, which is slightly smaller than a UK or an imperial gallon.
Yeah,
but that doesn't make it any easier for us to take, believe me.
It's not per liter, it's per gallon.
Yeah, exactly.
But the lead, but the ethanol free is about less than a pound more a gallon than that.
I should say that these calculations and conversion charts often play into the regular Friday night Skype sessions, reinforcing the two nations separated by a common language. Talking more about the commando, you recently had a bit of trouble with that, didn't you? Which Ray was, much to your scepticism, able to steer you in a somewhat helpful direction. Is that right?
You remember the exhaust oil there.
Oh, well, yes. I guess that's a standard commando problem, from what I've seen and heard from other people. The exhaust nut, you know, with the vibration and it, the whole engine and everything being, you know, rubber mounted, you get a vibration and flexing of the components. And those threads in the head wear down.
Yeah.
And I was coming home from a meeting, a motorcycle meeting, one night, and all of a sudden my on the commando, and all of a sudden the exhaust got noticeably louder. It's fairly loud anyway with this 2-in-1 system. But I looked down and there was flame shooting out of the head, you know, about that far out, you know, 6 inches in advance of the engine. I thought, well, this isn't right. And I pulled over, and of course I had gloves on, and I tried to screw it back in, but it was pretty hot. Luckily, I was less than a quarter mile from home. So I would fire it up, and then get up with speed, and then turn it off and coast as far as possible and repeat that until I got home. And, you know, the standard way to fix it right, from what I understand, is to weld in an insert and, you know, with new threads and do it properly. But not knowing how long I'm going to keep this bike and through the teardown procedure and the hassle. Spray, is there any, you know, any quick and dirty fixes? well, Ray recommended high temperature silicone sealant, and I, you know, put that around the nut, and it would screw in loosely, but just not enough to hold it under pressure. Mm-hmm. So I screwed it in, and also safety wired in two places, a couple of the fins. One went under the rocker box nut, and one I actually drilled a small, tiny hole in the cylinder fin and lock wired it back. So I've got two lock wires holding that exhaust nut on in case the silicone gives way. At least I won't it won't blow out, and it'll get me home.
Yeah, I mean we've had surprisingly good results with that product, because as you know, with the push in downpipes on both BSA and on Triumph as well, back in the day they were falling out all over the place, and you know, you really did struggle to find some remedy, and obviously with the Triumph stub mounts where they're threaded into the head, as you say, the only real solution back in the day was to take them off, have them welded up and re-threaded. But we've found that the physical strength that the copper coloured high temperature silicon Loctite product, the physical strength that it's got, really does do an impressive job, and none of the A65s, for example, that we've ever used it on, we've ever had a problem with. So, as you say, a quick and dirty fix maybe, but also one that you may be good to go for a while yet.
So we've learnt a little bit about who you are, Jack, but I suppose the elephant in the room is you're in Memphis, Tennessee. We're in sunny Bedfordshire, or dark Bedfordshire, as it is outside at the moment. How did the two of you come to meet?
Well, my wife and I had taken a couple of to England, and I think it was in 1999. We were taking another driving tour around and through England, and I had noticed an article in either Classic Bike or The Motorcyclist or some magazine. It listed museums, motorcycle museums, and shops around England. So I thought, well, here's a chance to incorporate our cultural tour with a little museums and shops, and who knows what I'll see or find. And, you know, it's and we were just about at the end of our tour. I stopped at a couple of places. We'd been to different shops and motorcycle museums around the country. And just about near our end of our visit and heading back down to London, and I said, well, here's a place, RJM Motorcycle or something was listed in Horsley. And so I said, well, I was a little town. How hard can that be to find? And of course, this was before GPS or anything like that. Yeah. It was just a road map.
Yeah.
And
in monochrome.
It's the dark ages.
Yeah.
And went up and down the, I think it was the High Street or something, but
yeah, we were the longest. We used to be the longest village in the country, and I think we're only not now because we're technically a town by population.
Oh no, I think we had the choice.
Oh really?
I think we decided to change. Nobody asked me.
Well,
anyway,
sorry, Jack.
You're going up and down Owsley High Street and not finding us.
Yeah, looking, not finding you at all, and. We might have stopped in a shop and asked, where is this RJM or something? But we finally, on like the last pass, I said, well, I'll look one more time. We saw a sign on a column, and it said RJM Motorcycles or something. I said, well, this has got to be it.
What we should point out is we tend to keep our whereabouts a little bit quiet, so we're not so inundated with people who just want to come around and have a look around. Not that that's a problem, and being that bit tucked away.
Tire kickers like me. You know, I mean, all these people from the States who are, you know, you want to keep out the riff.
I was simply giving the disclaimer that it wasn't entirely your fault that you couldn't find us in the pre-GPS days.
There you go.
And I think now, from what Ray told me, the sign has fallen off or taken it down, so like nobody can find you now. Well, you're completely incognito.
I think one of our commercial neighbours decided to accidentally remove my sign so he could put his own one up, and frankly, at that point, I just couldn't be asked anymore.
But I'm sorry, as you were, so you've finally found us, or just Ray, as it was at the time.
Well, and perhaps I can pick up the story there, because it was. It was a sunny summer Friday afternoon, and not long after I parted company with my former business partner, so I was, you know, very much getting into, you know, the flow of being one man operated, and this stranger came through my door, and of course, unbeknownst to him, in the preceding few years, I'd acquired a bit of an interest in. Stock car racing, NASCAR and the like. So I could place the accent, give or take, straight away, and announce that I had got a rough idea and that I was a NASCAR fan. And his reply to me was, oh, you like the good old boys, do you?
I was surprised to find someone there who even knew what NASCAR was, much less has an interest. So... we kind of made a deal on the spot. He traded me some of his Team Sarah racing stickers. He just gave me some stickers from his racing days. And I said, well, I'll send you something from NASCAR when I get home. And I don't know if he expected to ever hear from me again or not.
I'm not sure.
But I followed up. And then send him some NASCAR stickers, I think, and some, maybe some product stickers. And that started our two-way communications.
Yes, it did. And back in that day, in those days, you were working full-time for the Coast Guard. And our main method of communication was email via your business computer.
Yes, and I would do that in my spare time. I didn't have a computer back in those days, so I would go to a library, and you could get an hour computer time, and we would email back and forth. And he finally persuaded me, after a couple of years of this, to get my own computer, which I did. And no sooner I got a computer that he started bugging me to get a Skype connection, which I duly did.
You were a bit skeptical. And, you were a bit skeptical, Jack.
Yeah, all this newfangled technology is throwing at me, and but it's been a good thing, and we've had a lot of communication, and for a whole lot cheaper price that way than
you could. Yeah, you can't get cheaper than free once you're set up. I think it's an amazing service, and you know, we obviously have our regular weekly Skype sessions, and you know, it's a great motorcycling and cultural exchange. And to think that all came about just because of you finally managing to find me, and popping your head through the door and having an immediate kindred interest, amazing.
But as well as the social aspect, you and your friends have also been very helpful to us as a business. But before we move on to that, a bit more on the social side of things, we can, you know, learn all sorts of information about what goes on your side of the pond and what things were like, and really just why British motorcycles? Why does this this guy from Memphis, Tennessee? Why, surely you should be a Harley man.
Well, you would think that'd be the most logical. Memphis is actually quite a big British motorcycle town. Even back in the 60s, there's a lot of interest in British motorcycles, and there's kind of, you know, two camps. There was the Harley people and the British motorcycle people, and you had a few oddballs, of course, who had Italian machines, and then you got the BMW people, but it was primarily either Harley or British of some variety.
You had two Triumph dealers in Memphis, didn't you?
Even in Memphis, which wasn't that big, especially in the 60s, we had two authorized Triumph dealers.
Wow.
And one had been this for many years, and the other one kind of came up and went away after a couple of years. But we also had a BSA dealership, and we had a Norton dealer. So we were well represented. And British motorcycles were, if you wanted to be different, you might say, you would kind of tend towards the British stuff.
Yeah.
And my dad, who kind of got me into motorcycling, was definitely different. If he was English, he would have been called an eccentric. He was a motorcyclist from way back. And he actually encouraged me to get into motorcycles. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I could get on the bicycle almost, he would put little two-stroke motors on bicycle frames.
Wow.
One of them went down near the pedal sprocket, and you have to pedal the thing, and you change the motor and power it. And the other one mounted on the front wheel of the bicycle, a little two-stroke, and it had a roller wheel, and you would start it and drop the wheel down on your front tire, and that would transmit power to your front wheel. And of course, those weren't road legal or anything, but rode them around the yards. But like I say, he was a bit of eccentric. He actually, and an Anglophile, he, back in the mid-50s, he actually flew to New York City and bought a Riley automobile.
Oh, my goodness.
And drove it home.
Wow.
And, you know, it had the little turn signals on the B-pillar and
the running board. The old semaphore signals, yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. And he was in... stuff like Volkswagen Microbus in Memphis. He saw one of the companies that bought one, and so he said, I want one of those.
He almost single-handedly invented the Campbell van, didn't he?
He foresaw that the Microbus would make a good camper, I think, years before Volkswagen reached that conclusion, because he outfitted this little van. He bought a folding bed, a folding cot, and put in it, and bought an army surplus cook stove, and made a mattress, and I would sleep up over the engine. This is like mid-1950s, maybe 56.
Think of the money you could have made if he'd got a patent for it.
We took the thing all the way out to the Grand Canyon.
Really?
Wow. Oh, fantastic.
It did have an awning which went out over the side of it. You could throw a rope over the van and tie it down and over the side with enclosures. And my mother would cook on a Coleman stove, and we were completely self-sufficient.
Yeah.
But that was the early days of camping, so he was...
He was ahead of his time. Great story.
Mm-hmm. But he encouraged me in the motorcycles, as I said.
Yep.
And in the earlier days, I think he had actually had a Harley or an Indian, I think he said, and maybe a Henderson. Mm-hmm. But when I was growing up, he had, it was rather disappointing, had a motorcycle called a Simplex.
Right.
Mm. And I think it was the only motorcycle ever manufactured in the South.
Right.
They were built in New Orleans. Uh-huh. Like a 1935 design. It still had a belt going to the rear wheel. I'm sure it wouldn't get out of its own way. And it was disappointing. All these guys had these, you know, real motorcycles. He had this little two-stroke, but, you know, that was his way of being different.
Yeah.
But he would fix me up these bikes with motors. And this brings up to around 1961 or 2 or something. The first real motorcycle I had was a Honda, I guess it was a C110, a little 50cc Super Sports Cub.
Right.
That was the first store-bought motorcycle I ever had. And I rode it for a year or two. And by the time I got to 16 or something, I could ride a bigger horsepower. And a friend of mine had a Tiger Cub, a Triumph Tiger Cub.
Yep.
And I sort of, that sounded like and looked like a real motorcycle to me.
It did. The thing that always impressed me about the Tiger Cub when I was small is that actually, although it's quite a diminutive bike, it was perfectly in proportion. So if you saw a photograph of a Tiger Cub and no point of reference, unless you knew what you were looking at, you wouldn't know whether it was a 200, a 500, or whatever.
Right. Small yet
perfectly formed. Yeah.
And and so I'd always kind of wanted, that led me towards Triumph. So in 1963, we got a Triumph T100, the 500cc single carburetor.
Yeah.
And I think it had like a little skirt fairing half, you know.
What they called a bikini bathtub.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure it had that on it, which, like, you know, a good American did. We took those things out.
Yeah,
obviously. Away.
Well, same over here.
We took them off as well. That, in fact, the foreshortened or what we ended up calling the bikini bathtub, I don't think I've seen a set on a bike in 30 years.
No, and boy, it didn't look that bad, but I mean, I wanted the full sport effect after buying a Triumph 500.
Right.
So
yeah.
We had that for several years, well up until 1970, when we bought the TR6.
Yeah.
And I've had it ever since.
Yeah.
See, and it's just a cultural exchange like that, that had you not popped through the door, would be poorer.
Our lives would be poorer in many ways, Jack.
Absolutely.
So let's get back to business. Talk a bit more about the little circle of friends and enthusiasts and people doing it more professionally as well. Your side of the pond and how you've helped us out in the past.
Well, since I got to know Ray, our relationship has come closer and encompassing all things, you know, motorcycle. From time to time, he's mentioned needing a specific part or this or that. And I have several friends over here and connections, and we've been able to come up with stuff to help him. You know, I guess during the latter part of the Triumph's run, they were selling more bikes over here than they were in England. So we have quite a few motorcycles and parts, supplies. And as dealers went out of the business, people would buy them up, and they would go out of business, and parts would change hands. And of course, through eBay or stuff, you can find parts from all over the country if need be. But sometimes just knowing the right person who has a supply of things has helped. And so over the years, we've sent him numerous packages of parts, from connecting rods to engine case covers and a few
gearboxes lately.
That's a good example. That's just a recent example as well. Talk about that.
Well, I mean, the thing is, from my view of it, because I mean, there used to be a lot of secondhand stock kicking around in the UK 20-25 years ago, but of course, rampant restoration over that time has put pay to most of that. Now, what I read of the scene over in Memphis, and particularly what Steve Steinbrink's got stashed away, you know, that's the sort of level of used and usable stock that we would have had over here 25 years ago. But of course, we don't. And to know Steve's got those bits and pieces that we can very often persuade him to to sell us if he's not got a use for it. And also Steve Herr, who is, I mean, he's a full-time motorcycle repairer, isn't he, in Memphis?
Yeah.
He's got a fair amount of British stuff.
He does. He has maybe, I don't know, 100, maybe close to 100 bikes, mostly British bikes, I guess.
Yeah.
In back of his shop.
Yeah.
And occasionally he will take parts off of those if he has them to spare and send to you.
Just to give a few examples of some of the things that you've you and the people your side of the pond have helped us out with, Ray, what was a recent example that you're still telling everybody about to this day?
Well, of course, the real famous one, the one that I'm still pinching myself over, is an A65 cylinder head. Now, I say to folk, I'm very easily led, and in an earlier podcast I talk about how I persuaded myself to go twin disc on the front end of my still under construction A65 CAF racer. But similarly, we were working on a BSA Thunderbolt for a client, and as it turned out, the head was junk. I mean, it really was junk. And he said, "Oh, that's all right, I'll go on eBay, see if I can find a new one." And I thought, right, good luck with that. Well, about 2 days later, he got back to me. Oh, he said, "I found a new cylinder head on eBay. I've put it in the post here." Well, now, that was fine. It was a Thunderbolt one, and I thought, well, single carb one, you know, you wouldn't find a Lightning one like that. And I decided to have a little search online, and lo and behold, I found a brand new cylinder head for a 1968 Lightning. Never been touched, never been fitted to a machine. Now, was it, where was it? I thought it was
Illinois.
Illinois. Yes, I thought it was Iowa, but Illinois. And of course, this was on eBay, and we were going to be Skyping within a couple of hours, and I couldn't wait to get online fast enough. because rather than, you've always got the complication if you're trying to order stuff from the UK, from the States direct, obviously shipping gets a bit tiresome, and you're not, if there is a problem with it, you've got a devil's own job sending it back. Well, of course, this is where Jack, bless his heart, comes in, and Susan, who obviously does a bit of the packaging as well.
That was sent down to me, and then I...
You packaged that up beautifully for me. I mean, there's a vendor is unlikely to take that sort of care and effort, and you did. You were very innovative, because I mean that to me, getting a brand new cylinder head for something like that, and of course the project as it is now is a virtual bloody new build. I mean, there's so little of the original bike I've used, but to get a brand new cylinder head for a twin carb Lightning is like the holy grail. So thank you for that. But more recently, it's been gearboxes, isn't it?
It has. I think we've sent you a Triumph gearbox and a BSA gearbox, which I think is going to need a little bit of reconditioning work done. But I think the latest thing is you were looking for some close ratio gears for BSA.
Yeah.
And you only needed three particular gears.
Oh, this is I should say that the initial problem was that we actually needed a gearbox for a client, and by gearbox I mean basically the cluster.
Well, I'll set the scene because this is a full restoration, and as I'm looking through the gearbox, I'm rotating these gears, having stripped it apart, going, "Oh, well, that one's not too bad." Oh, okay. Well, this one here, I mean, this would probably... Oh, okay. No, it wouldn't. It was just... Some of them looked okay in places, but there was a real nasty patch of corrosion on every single one of these. At least one nasty patch of corrosion.
Well, and where the case hiding had been breached.
Well,
just about
of course,
gear.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, that will precipitate tooth failure if you're even only moderately unlucky. So one... In fact, the first inquiry that you made with Steve, he really couldn't come up with anything at all as regards a gearbox cluster for this particular client. But I resigned myself to the fact that I'd have to, you know, do some more searching in the UK. But then he took it into his head to pick one up at Barber, didn't he?
He picked one up at Barber. It's a complete gear set, main shaft, lay shaft. The whole works, I think, was $99, $100 or something.
Something like that, yeah.
And one or two, I think two of the gears had a bit of pitting on them when we started inspecting it real closely when we got it home. But he had a box full of extra gears,
yeah.
And he just swapped those out of his stock and sent them to you. So you got a nice set of gear for $100.
Was it a Skype call? I think it was a phone call, because I'd as part of this hunt for bits for gearboxes, I'd started looking again, and particularly the one we wanted for parts for a client's gearbox. Although this bike was pretty unremarkable, it had got a close ratio cluster in it, and I thought, do you know what, given the searching I've done in the past, there's no way we're going to find close ratio gears. But it prompted me to start looking again. And I found one or two in the UK and then a couple from odd vendors in the States. And I'm thinking, well, this is going to be way too expensive for a client who actually doesn't need a close ratio box on his machine. But actually, you know, I'm building this cafe racer, and that really would justify it. I mean, I had looked at a 5-speed option, but they want about £2,600 plus VAT, and I'm sorry, even I'm not that mad. So I was left with...
I mean, you got to respect the engineering that goes into it.
Oh, no, I mean...
We're not knocking it.
No, absolutely not, and it's great that somebody does, but I just couldn't justify it. Not on my pay rate. In fact, you passed the numbers over to Steve, who was going to have a look, see what he could find. And he came back with his people. Waldridge had got nothing, but that Randy Baxter probably had. So we put an inquiry via that route. Now, what I didn't tell you in the meantime is, of course, I was doing this negotiation direct with Steve Steinbrink, and loaded the extra money needed into PayPal and sent it to you. And I got this strange phone call from you to say, there's something strange going on here. I all of a sudden acquired $500. And of course, we'd done the transaction.
$500 appeared to cover these the gears. I didn't know that this was actually in the works.
No, you didn't.
The gears were being sent to me at that point.
It just goes to show your honesty, doesn't it? Tell us the journey that the gears went on to get to where they are now.
Largely unbeknownst to me, this quest had gone from Ray to Memphis, Steve, up to Canada, to his contact there, over to Iowa, sourced these gears, and they were sent.
They're still with you. They're still with you at the moment, and they're waiting for the next, I don't know, what would you describe the regular package as, the next milk run?
Oh, right, okay. I didn't know that.
But, the fact...
I've got them, and they'll be enclosed in the next package.
Bless your heart.
Headed your way with whatever else you come up that you need.
Yeah. Personally and commercially, I'm happy to state once again that our lives will be poorer without you.
Yeah, we did have one other example we were going to talk about, which actually involved Jack sat there on Skype with his cell phone in his hand, talking to a supplier with us at the other end of Skype, and we do that quite often actually with Steve Steinbrink and whatnot, don't we?
But this was Micromesh.
Okay,
wasn't it?
Let's tell the story.
Do you remember us trying to get hold of Micromesh cushioned abrasives, and you actually phoned up the factory? While I was listening,
we were on Skype talking, and you were saying you needed this product, Micromesh, this polishing cloth. And I never heard of it, but we looked it up on the internet while we were talking. And it was up in Iowa somewhere. And it had a phone number listed for the factory.
And Jack says, let's phone them now.
I said, well, we're here, so I picked up.
he
I called the factory and got some lady there, some girl there, desk, and explaining to her what specific products we, I said, I got a friend in England who needs a roll of number whatever grit or something.
I think it was 180 MX, but
yes, no, you're right.
Yeah.
He says, oh, we don't have any of that on hand at the moment, but we can. I can tell them over at the plant, and we'll make you a batch.
Yeah.
I thought, well, now there's customer service. And I said, well, you'd make us a batch, a special run we just need one roll. We don't need the truckload. She said, well, that's what we do.
She was such a sweet child.
And within a few days, I had it, and I shipped it over to you. So just another example of can do. Get you what you need.
I'm going to leave this in because it's brilliant. You went, well, it's just another example of, and then we totally lost you. Doesn't that just sum up the situation entirely?
Yeah. I don't know why, Jack, but that's been a swine of a connection this afternoon or this morning for you. What time is it there?
We may never know.
We may never know. No, it's been
a really well never know. Oh, no, he's back. Is he? No.
It's been a swine of a connection, but I really appreciate you having persevered through it to prove to all my friends and clients that you're not just my imaginary friend.
Not a figment of your imagination.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I only hope that the talk of the Skype connection being a nightmare will come as a huge surprise to the listeners and the viewers, depending on how well I've edited this. Jack, I think that's all we got to say. Have you got anything you'd like to attempt to say before we sign off here?
I'd just like to invite your listeners and clients and customers or whatever, if they're they ever come to Memphis, if they find themselves here on Wednesday evenings from mid-April to mid-October, we have called Bill Street Bike Night. And Bill Street is sort of like a mini condensed version of the French Quarter. It's only two blocks long, but there's lots of clubs and music activities and tourist attractions and things like that. But on Wednesday nights from about 6:30 to whenever, the police block off the street and reserve it for motorcycles.
Wow. Mm.
And on a good night, I mean, there'll be 300 or 400 bikes there. Mm. And a few of them British. And we get people from all over the world, and a lot of British tourists. I usually meet anywhere from 4 to 8 or 10 almost every Wednesday night there, and they're quite surprised to see the motorcycles out. So it's it's just a free show, and it's the best free show in town. So if they find themselves in Memphis on Wednesday night, April to October, just come down to Bill Street and look for a British motorcycle. It may be me.
You've got your own special way of stalking the foreigners, haven't you?
Well, yes, it used to be, it's getting rather difficult now, not quite as efficient, but used to, you could just look for the strange shoes and you could tell of foreigners by their shoes, but now with everybody wearing, jogging shoes or such.
Yeah.
But you still get a few hardcore Europeans who wear, sandals and socks. they're identifiable. But the British bikes in particular seem to attract attention to a lot of people. Yeah. And it's funny, you can be, have my humble little bike sitting there next to a $30,000 paint job.
Yeah.
And gravitate towards my bike just because of, the styling or what it is. So yeah. I've struck up many conversations and found a lot of friends from the tourists.
Yeah.
So I invite them to come by if they're here on us.
And we've seen a lot of pictures you sent us of Bike Night, and it really is pretty impressive, isn't it?
It is. You got a lot of characters there, and tourists and locals, and it's a real melting pot of the Memphis motorcycle community. And we even have about a dozen or so scooters that turn up, and everybody just gets along real well, has a good time, and like I say, it's the best show in town.
Jack, thank you very much. We got
been my pleasure, boys.
Well, that's all from us this week. If you like that, you can subscribe on YouTube, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also visit our website, rjmclassic.com, or email me specifically about the podcast at rjmpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.